Hello and welcome to another episode of Art Matters. Recently, the Plan of Nashville exhibit curator Gary Gaston and Christine Kraling, author of the book on the plan, visited the library to discuss the exhibition. I hope you will enjoy their conversation and encourage you to come see The Plan of Nashville, Avenues to a Great City, on display at the main library through January 10th, 2010.
It's hard to believe it's been 5 years when I look at all this stuff, because it seems like it was just yesterday that we pulled all this together.
And the process that went into all of this, I think, is one of the big inspirations for doing this exhibition at the library, because this is over 200 linear feet of wall space. And
it's covered. It's double hung. It's like the old European salons.
Yeah. So, Christine, I thought we could just kind of do a quick introduction to let people know a little bit about the Plan of Nashville who maybe are not familiar with it, and then just walk around the room and kind of talk about some of the drawings on the wall and the process that we went through to create the plan.
Sure.
And where we're kind of headed in the future.
I was thinking this morning when I drove down here that, you know, we've got the 10 principles and everything, but, and this introductory panel makes this clear, community-based vision. I think the overriding principle with this whole exhibit, and which you can see through the whole exhibit, but which was part of the whole process, is that it was a bottom-up process, not a top-down kind of process. And at the time, we take this for granted now because the planning department does their community vision plans and detailed neighborhood design plans and all those sorts of things. But at the time when we kicked this off, that wasn't the typical way that planning happened in Nashville. And it really is, I think, in reaction ultimately, from a historical standpoint, to the way urban renewal was done, which was just like, hey, we're the smart people. We're going to come in and bulldoze through your neighborhood with a six-lane highway or a big housing project or whatever. And I think the Plan of Nashville is kind of a culmination of the wave against that kind of approach. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of codified. I think one of the important things is people now expect, the average citizen who's interested in planning at all now expects to have a forum in which he or she can be heard.
Right. And even though the Plan of Nashville is based on the Plan of Chicago as sort of a broad ambition, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year, the Plan of Nashville, I think, is almost exactly opposite of what the Plan of Chicago was in that aspect.
So,
which is very much a grassroots effort. It's just like what you were talking about.
Talk about a little bit about the workshops and things that we did. I was trying to remember, because there were a number of different meetings, was it sort of like we asked people at first, tell us what you like about your neighborhood and what you don't like, and that sort of thing? Remind me about how that worked.
I think there were a series of three rounds of public meetings, which when we get around to the map of how we divided the city, I think that'll be good to point out. But yes, the first round was sort of just an introduction, went out to the leaders of the neighborhoods and the community and said, here's who we are, here's what we're going to be doing, and who else needs to be a part of this conversation, and also letting them be a part of going out and recruiting people and saying, you know, this is going to be good for our community and we want you to participate. And then the next series was sort of the first public meeting where citizens and residents from the communities were asked, what do you like about your neighborhood? What would you like to see stay the same? What would you like changed? And that's also where we began working on the Nashville timeline, where we asked them what was a significant event that happened in their community. And then the next meeting was called the Community Vision Workshops, where we, just asked people to vision and envision the future of their community and their neighborhoods. And then there was one final public meeting where we brought everyone together, and we called that Building Consensus, where we kind of pulled everything together at the end.
And I'm looking at this panel here that's got essentially the names of everybody who participated. How many names are we talking about here?
I think there are over 800 individuals. And you have to keep in mind that, you know, most of these people participated in multiple meetings.
Right.
So I think, you know, it's just really impressive to see this.
I mean, I'm seeing a lot of names that I know, my neighbors, politicians, architects, people from MDHA, artists. I mean, it's just a pretty interesting kind of roll call of people who care about Nashville, I think.
Yeah. And then, you know, lots of neighborhood people that we've kept in contact over the years with also.
It was divided up, I mean, the territories for the workshops were divided up geographically. They were kind of like pie pieces, weren't they?
And right, yes. And just, I mean, I think, Christine, you had mentioned, just starting here on this panel, we have two different aerial photographs of Nashville. And one is from 1959, and the other one is from, I believe, 2006. What's interesting about this aerial photograph is this is pre-interstate, so you can see what you were talking about with how the interstate system really, you know, from one photograph to the other, how it really did sever a lot of the neighborhoods. You can just see here the beginnings of,
right, that's where they're doing 65, but right. Yeah.
And you do see most of the public housing developments have already been built. Of course, there's the first, Capitol Hill, Capitol Mall, I think that's
Capitol Mall. The Capitol Mall redevelopment area, the first urban renewal project in the country, mm-hmm. which was late 40s, early 50s, I think, around what sort of birthed James Robertson Parkway. And clearly there was a lot of slums in that area that needed to be addressed, but essentially it took out a neighborhood and replaced it with a bunch of
parking lots.
Yeah, not very distinguished office buildings. Right. Yeah. The grain is so much finer in this pre-interstate photograph. I mean,
one of the things I noticed a lot is how the interstate on the East Bank took out, you know, all the streets and buildings, which I guess primarily was industrial just along the river's edge and then created more of an industrial area.
I think starting
area.
At about 3rd or something like that. The interstate basically went through at about 4th, but starting at about 3rd, there were houses. I mean, it was a regular neighborhood. That was part of Edgefield and then just got sort of blasted.
Let's talk about, just a minute before we move on, about the 10 principles. And what's your memory of how that kind of came about?
I remember a lot of meetings. Now, we basically, I think, had asked people to talk. I mean, we were trying to deduce them from the specific things that the citizens came up with in connection with their own neighborhoods. And what we did was we kind of tried to distill it down into more general principles that could be applied beyond the boundaries of individual neighborhoods. And I remember Marlene Davis, then the dean of the UT College of Architecture, as being instrumental in really distilling these into 10, because we kind of went back and forth, and we've got subpoints underneath each of these 10. But, I mean, just by way of example, respect Nashville's natural and built environment. That's principle number one. That really could be applied to any place in Metro. Mm-hmm. Treat the Cumberland River as central to Nashville's identity. That was one of the things that really came out strongly, more strongly than I had expected among all the citizens, was that, hey, we've got this great river with very picturesque, good scenic possibilities, good recreational possibilities, and we're still treating it as if it's an industrial canal and we're living in the 19th century.
Almost not a single place where you could even go and touch the water.
Right. Develop convenient and efficient transportation infrastructure. We're obviously still, that's probably the heaviest lifting right. item among all the 10, because it's so complex and because it's a system that stretches beyond the boundaries of Metro.
Just looking through these 10 principles, I mean, I think there are a few that stand out as things that are actively happening. Well, several that are actively happening all throughout the city. So I think that these really do represent almost every area of development, but trying to promote that in the highest quality way possible.
Well, for example, provide for a comprehensive interconnected greenway and park system. I mean, the greenway people have made huge strides in terms of developing segments of the whole master plan for greenways and connecting them to each other. I mean, we've now got the bridge across the Cumberland River that connects Shelby Bottoms with the Stones River Greenway, and we're adding to Peeler Park and creating a greenway out there, possibly having a bridge across that would again connect with the Stones River Greenway in the not-too-distant future, we hope. And then we've got the whole planning right now for open space that's not just park space throughout the county.
Let's move on just briefly on the way that we organized the exhibition. We kind of wanted the exhibition to be a story about the book. And so if you look at the way that this is laid out, we have one whole wall devoted to the history section of the Plan of Nashville. We have a wall that's devoted to the process that went into creating the plan. another wall that's actually drawings that were created during the plan and went into the book. And we have a tiny little space at the end here that's devoted to kind of some of the things that have happened over the last 5 years. So let's start with talking about the history section. And this is your great achievement, I think, Christine. You undertook the writing of this, and I think it's, a lot of people probably think that it's one of the most impressive parts of the book because it really looks at the city from how it developed and how we started and then kind of all the way through our, and where we are now and where we're going. So,
well, I relied a lot on, well, a library of books about Nashville that I've been collecting for 20 years, but also some of the interns down at the Design Center really did some major research for me on specific things about urban renewal in Nashville, housing in Nashville, census information that I wouldn't necessarily have had access to or would have known how to. But I felt the history was really important. And there were skeptics who thought that when we were crunching our deadlines, they thought, well, let's just not do history. We don't have to. And it's true, we didn't, in the sense that there's many, many plans. I looked at, for example, the comprehensive plan for Los Angeles. It didn't have much of a history section. But I really thought it was important to understand, not history in the sense of when did Robertson and Donaldson, you know, get off the boat or come overland, but in terms of how Nashville, like many cities in the United States, developed in three dimensions, because it seemed to me that it was only from that perspective that we could understand where we were standing today and what we needed to do for the future. There's a quote, I think. Yeah, okay. Here it is, G.K. Chesterton. The disadvantage of men not knowing the past is that they do not know the present. History is a hill or high point of vantage from alone which men see the town in which they live or the age in which they are living. I liked that hill or high vantage point because, of course, that is where they laid out the public square, which was the inception of Nashville itself. And so I thought that quote reflected what we were doing historically, but also what happened in Nashville topographically and geographically.
And this quote, history is all explained by geography.
Right.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, I mean, what he was alluding to, I think, and what I took him to mean was, I mean, we've got the Highland Rim that's the kind of horseshoe opening towards the south that inscribes Nashville and Middle Tennessee. All the water running down that rim basically carried topsoil, which created really rich soils for farming. It created a sort of microclimate that's milder, perhaps, than immediate surroundings to the north. Of course, it also creates very hot weather in the summer when it catches those breezes from the south. But I think the fact that the wild game that was the reason for the Native Americans to come here and then for the original trappers before the settlers came, that all had to do with salt licks and limestone streams and everything, which was all determined by the topography and geography of Nashville.
Mm-hmm. One of the first things that I thought was interesting was seeing this, the Molloy plat, which was the first platting of the city. And I believe this was 1815 when this happened. But I guess as someone who's very familiar with downtown Nashville, I see the difference between what was sort of laid out and what the reality is now, which this is a very regular street system. Looks like every street is aligned and you know, there were alleys were all supposed to be aligned. And then we all know the reality of Nashville is very much different than that. Do you think that's a kind of based on the geography and how?
I think this kind of platting, and this map we're looking at is 1815, but the Molloy plan was, I think, 1784. This is really before Tennessee, when we were still part of North Carolina. The whole country, the national survey that was done at the instigation of Thomas Jefferson of 1785, basically platted the whole country in terms of acres and 640 acres in these divisions, and then you kind of divide down from there. And so I think it wasn't sensitive to topography. You just put this grid down, and that was a way to essentially turn land into real estate, I think, because that's what it was. I mean, the biggest business on the frontier when Nashville was first established was land speculation, and a measurable sort of predictable system is what it was the easiest way to sort of carve up the territory. But you're right, it didn't turn out that way, although there's some odd but true. You'll notice these odd little numbers in there. The actual blocks and parcels within there were slightly off and strangely off, like 126-foot frontage is certainly not a standard number, you know? But it's interesting to see how what I find most fascinating is that they thought of a public square right at the beginning.
Right.
And they also thought about 200 acres surrounding it, which were common lands, mostly in Sulphur Delta, the north, in the lower-lying areas that was common grazing ground, was used for burial ground, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
So as we look down the history section, we see lots of maps that kind of chart the development. Here we have 1831, City of Nashville. You start to see buildings called out on the public square.
Yeah, they basically started out with, a jail and some kind of office and market space, and a church. I think a Methodist church was there originally, the first stone building, I think, on the square.
And this is one of my favorite, this 1855 view of Nashville. It looks like from the Rolling Mill Hill.
Yeah.
And you can see that, the two landmarks that really stand out prominently are obviously the Capitol, which was the tallest thing in the city, and then the two towers of the Presbyterian Church.
Right, William Strickland. Yeah. For both of those buildings.
Both by Strickland.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, I love to see how the city developed. You see the Edgefield map. One of the most amazing maps that we laughed about, I think, when we found it, was the streetcar lines from the 1920s.
Yeah.
Where you just, I look at my house in East Nashville, and I had the possibility of two different routes, neither of which was more than two blocks from my house.
I mean, this is almost the public transportation system that we are trying to recreate
exactly.
Now.
Yeah, exactly.
And will cost a lot of money to get back what we once had.
I saw recently when they were repairing some road work near Shelby Park in East Nashville that they had pulled the old asphalt up, and you could still see some of the some rails underneath.
It was just cheaper to pave over instead of rip those up.
And you can see here's a picture where they're paving roads, and there was here's one where they're taking WPA workers are taking streetcar tracks off of Church Street during the 1930s. It was decided to remove that line, I guess.
So then we get, that was a major era, but then you kind of get into we're reaching the point of urban renewal where we have these beautiful watercolor paintings that are kind of this picturesque, idealized notion of what the interstates were going to bring to the city.
Yeah, the Clark and Rapuana plan and this idealized watercolors you're talking about is based on that plan. They were engineers and planners. They actually did a campus plan for Vanderbilt University as well as plan for downtown in the immediate area. And the interstate is shown as, of course, there's no gridlock on the road at all. I mean, there's plenty of space between the cars. And these roads are surrounded by picturesque trees and fields and everything. There's no acknowledgement that once you cram a bunch of cars onto a specific road, people are going to want to try to sell them something. And so you'll get billboards and gas stations and all that kind of building is billboard thing that Venturi talked about in Learning from Las Vegas. So the East Bank clearly doesn't look anything like near the interstate doesn't look anything like this picturesque idyllic vision that's sketched out here.
And I think one thing that, especially as someone who's fairly new to Nashville when this process started, when I started looking at all these photographs of the historic buildings that we had downtown that were torn down, it was really sad to me.
And really lost a lot. And, well, when I first started writing about architecture, preservation, accepted preservationist, was sort of a hard sell. And relatively recently we lost the National Landmark Union Station train shed, things like that, but we're doing a lot better than we did. The picture that we're looking at here is part of the demolition of the buildings surrounding the public square, which were all obliterated in the 1970s, and a parking lot was constructed on one block that had just been totally demolished. And of course then we came back in an early 21st century and replaced the parking lot with a park with an underground garage underneath it. So it's sort of like what goes around comes around, but then the second time it comes around, it costs a lot more money.
Yeah. That reminds me of a funny quote from, I think it's Churchill, which I'll paraphrase, is that Americans will always do the right thing after they've exhausted every other alternative. Shall we move on maybe to the...
Sure.
Here's the maps that you were talking about earlier where we began looking at the process and how we were going to do the plan of Nashville. And just to briefly, I mean, I think, and a lot of this was already kind of decided on when I started at the Design Center, but there were multiple different team leaders who sort of took on a specific geographical area. And I know that you can see here some of the sketches of how we were looking at dividing the city's core and the surrounding neighborhoods. And, you know, it was, there was a lot of thought that went into this. And the way that we came up with was that we would use the historical pikes as sort of the boundaries, but not necessarily in the boundary of you stop thinking about this area at the pike. You always consider the area adjacent to you.
Because it's as much a zipper as it is a boundary.
Right. Yeah. So these are really thought of as zippers between neighborhoods and communities, I think.
I think what's interesting is that, I mean, we're looking at these colors, and there's darker as you get the color is darker, say green is a darker green when you're in the downtown sort of area, and then it kind of pales out as you go out Clarksville Pike and 3rd Avenue. But the idea was is that you wanted to link the downtown with the first ring neighborhoods immediately around it. In other words, counteracting what had happened with the sort of inner loop of the interstate, which basically said downtown is an island surrounded by these various neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. We were trying to go back in and re-knit that fabric, even while the interstate still exists, but nevertheless to get people inside the loop thinking about what was happening outside the loop and vice versa.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, wasn't initially it just supposed to be the area within the interstate and then kind of
we
realized that that was not
that, and then
a good idea?
It
and
seemed like that was not going to be. Well, because essentially this traditional sub-area 9 plan, the community plan for downtown, pretty much focused on inside the interstate mm-hmm. loop. And we felt that that was kind of a false division in part because sure. of the fact that if downtown, for example, retail is going to come back, it will depend on consumers in the area immediately around right. it. And you've got transportation patterns between these areas and things like that. So, and obviously people living downtown now tend to come outside the interstate loop to do their grocery shopping in the surrounding neighborhoods and things like that. So we needed to acknowledge that there were connections.
Well, it also goes back to what you're saying about geography, and obviously the interstate is not based on necessarily geography since
right.
it's man-made, but the pikes are definitely based on geography, that historical geography that we learned about in the history section. So
right, the pikes basically were followed animal trails to the Great Salt Lick in the Sulphur Dell area north of the state capital. And the animals basically were taking the path of least resistance. So if there were two hills and then there was this valley in between, they took that valley. And that's how the pikes really developed.
And that's why we have sort of this radial, you know, spoke system of streets.
Right, and it's also why, particularly in the Sobro area, you get that skewed grid where because you've got pikes kind of colliding, like you've got Murfreesboro Pike Lafayette colliding with Franklin Pike 8th Avenue at a certain point, and so that creates some mm-hmm. Odd-shaped parcels and odd-shaped blocks. They're not square or rectangular.
So as a part of the process, we really did a lot of different research on these types of issues that I think helped us to get a better understanding of what we once were. So here we're looking at a series of maps. I believe we went back to 1908 and just charted all the different conditions that were present in 1908. So we have, obviously, the streetcar maps that we had talked about and locations of churches and schools and right. different government institutions in the early part of the 1900s.
Yeah, this stuff I found really fascinating when I was working on the history section. But you can see, here's this, the natural conditions, and you can just see the topography. And if you put the pike overlay on that, it would really make sense as to why the pikes went where they did.
So here we turn the corner and we're at the process section, which really involves just maps that came directly from the community and the visioning sessions. And I think this is probably one of the most impressive parts of the exhibition, because you get to see kind of the creativity of people that took part in these meetings.
It was pretty intense, I can remember.
Yeah.
Because I observed a lot, not just the workshops and planning sessions for my own neighborhood, but I tried to go to all of them just to sort of see what people were coming up with. And people got really into it, in the sense that, not that they quarreled with each other, but they felt passionately about certain things. That, for example, I'm looking at this section of Metro Center, that Metro Center really needed more to acknowledge the fact that it used to be wetland and floodplain area, and that we're not talking about demolishing any buildings out there. The sort of generic suburban office park landscaping could possibly give way to something more environmentally sensitive and more historically accurate to reflect the conditions out there.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, particularly, I remember in the vision meetings, there were four meetings in the month of February. They all happened on, Saturday mornings, I think from 8 a.m. until noon. And we had probably, I would say, at least about 100 people at every single one of those meetings. So you're talking about a lot of dedication from people coming out and
being up that early. Well, and the team leaders all really, I think, because the team leaders were mostly planning and design professionals, weren't they?
Yes.
And they kind of, so they were kind of like herding the cats in all these sessions. And then beyond that, there was the staff of the design center that had to herd the herders, as it were, and pull it together between one geographical section and another.
And here's the timeline we talked about. Which the coolest thing about the timeline was, this started out as a blank piece of paper with just a blue line on it and all these dates. And so we took it to the meetings, and we would ask people at each meeting we went to with a different color sticky pad based on the area that we were in, to just tell us what the significant events were that happened in their community. And then this was all based on their memory or their parents' memory or their stories they heard from their grandparents. And so over that period of time, this actually became completely filled with facts, or maybe not necessarily facts, but things that people remembered in their community.
Some were anecdotes rather than facts.
Right, yes, stories. But,
yeah.
But it was just,
and we're,
just
we ended
seeing
up
this
with this thing. I can remember this
amazing.
Being down at the design center, lying on the floor and wondering how in the heck we were ever going to get this into the book. Because, I mean, we're standing here looking at a document that's, 13, 15 feet long?
Yeah.
Something like that.
And I think this timeline inspired the timeline that actually went into the Plan of Nashville, which
right.
is based more on sort of larger, broader facts related to urban design. But
well, we tried to focus on history in three dimensions, as opposed to, well, for example, here is Andrew Jackson is elected 7th president of the United States. Well, that's significant from a variety of ways. But National Medical Society founded in Law Courthouse on Public Square. That we would think twice about. We were interested that there was a log courthouse on the public square, but first steamboats arrive on the Cumberland River. That's a huge thing, and that would definitely go in the timeline when we had to come and edit it, because that had to do all with the whole transportation history of the city.
All of these maps kind of converged into one map, which is what we would get all the team leaders together and say, okay, look at all these 50 maps on the wall, and then how do you take all of this information and condense it into one map? And I think that was a huge undertaking, but that's kind of what you see happening here. Is
how did you do that? I was out of town. I had the good sense to go to Europe during this part of the whole process.
Well, each team leader and their sort of geographical area would come together for a meeting, and usually there were several different teams because they had all met together because they sort of didn't view their area in isolation. So, for instance, we're looking at the River District right now, which is kind of the area known as North Nashville, which I think is cool in itself, because the people that participated in that in those sessions, residents of that area didn't want to just be known as North Nashville. They thought that they wanted sort of a distinctive name, and if you look at the map, you see how the river kind of makes this huge bow, and each side of that is kind of bounded by the river, so they decided on being called the River District. But all of those team leaders got together and just kind of took down all of the information that was on the maps. And then they, I guess we call it synthesized drawings. And I guess in the end, it actually wasn't, there weren't a lot of competing ideas from the same areas. They kind of all came together. And this is actually where I think we first saw the idea of, you know, either getting rid of the interstate and or canyonizing it, and something that we called healing the street grid, which this area of all the communities in Nashville was probably the most hard hit by the interstate system. You can see it runs diagonal to the street grid, and then it cuts across in numerous areas. And all of these different neighborhoods, people that were once neighbors, all of a sudden had no, you know, were not even able to, or if their house wasn't destroyed, they were not even able to walk to someone who had once lived just a couple blocks away.
I can remember an interesting anecdote in connection with this. Michael Ames, who's the director of Vanderbilt Press and who was reading the sections that I was writing as I was writing them, I mean one section at a time because we were pushing deadlines with all of this process, and he had read this section about the River District, North Nashville, and the history of the impact of I-40 and the lawsuits over I-40 where the neighbors sued and were unsuccessful. And he read them as kind of an abstract, okay, this is Nashville's three-dimensional history. And then that fall, there was an election, and he was working in that area in a get-out-the-vote kind of effort. And so he had to crisscross back and forth through the River District, North Nashville. And I remember him calling up and saying, on his cell phone, saying, I know what you're talking about now because I can't get from A to B because the interstate cuts through, so I have to keep going around and driving around, whereas theoretically, you know,
this would have
been
a grid and
all. Walk if it's all on 17th Street or something, I should be able to walk, but I can't.
Mm-hmm. Here's some photographs of people that participated in the meetings, and just you get a chance to see some of the energy that was happening during these sessions.
And I love all these little drawings.
These sketches came about, I think, when we were talking about, this is kind of just something that popped into our heads, but we were saying, well, we're going to have people, during these meetings, we're taking notes on these maps, we're drawing sketches on maps. We've got someone who's taking notes of what people are saying on a flip pad, but the idea came about, what if we had people, talented people who could draw, sketch artists, that were actually taking what we called visual notes. So this is what happened. If someone was at a meeting and they mentioned something about, well, I want to see, you know, this amazing riverfront. So you get someone who was taking an actual sketch of that. I thought that these turned out just really nice.
Some of these are fun, like the sort of plug and socket.
Yeah.
Where you're trying to sort of heal.
One of my favorite ones. I can't know if I can find it.
Remember Omari?
Omari.
Omari Green, this great
He came to every
kid. He
meeting.
Came to every meeting. He just, how old was he then?
He was 17, 16,
yeah,
I think.
Something yeah. like that.
And went to one of the magnet schools here, I think. I love this sketch. Athens of the South, and kind of talks about the culture. And then there's another one that's like a plug-in socket, and then the interstate is between.
Yeah.
Yeah. River and interstate.
But these are fun. I mean, because they show that people were just kind of spinning off in a real informal way. They show the freedom that people felt to sort of imagine.
Yeah. This is kind of a similar thing that kids did for drawing the future of Nashville. These were all done during a session. Actually, this is what we gave people during the meeting, building consensus meeting, where we asked them to help us develop a vision statement for the future of the city. So there's all kinds of different ideas on that. So now we're walking into the plan section, which is just drawings and sketches and illustrations that were done. That sort of was the next stage of things. Based after the visioning, we went into a production mode, and we tried to do drawings that captured the spirit of what people wanted to see happen.
This started, I guess, in the summer of what year?
2004. Wow. Are you sure? I think it was 2003, but could be wrong.
Oh, here's a wonderful picture that shows, where's the caption? This is all about what we called Spaghetti Junction and the Ellington Parkway, access into downtown, which got special treatment. David Kaline wrote up a whole little section about that, pointing out the fact of how much acreage is occupied that could be producing tax revenues for the city and is occupied by these coiling,
confusing swirling ramps.
Road patterns, yeah. We also, this section, the plan section, also shows how much we pulled on resources, experts from outside of Nashville for what we called sidebars, special boxes that people would contribute, because we felt there were certain questions. For example, if we boulevardize sections of the interstate, where will the traffic go? And so we asked Walter Kulosh, who's a nationally known transportation planner and traffic engineer, to respond to that question, which he did. John Nork was president of the Congress for the New Urbanism, also commented on the interstate.
I think it was funny. These ideas came out of the vision sessions. It was kind of what people wanted to see happen. So, you know, I think some people said, oh, that's crazy, you can't do that. And we sort of said, well, this is what people want, and the idea of a vision plan. So I think we kind of went into it and said, okay, here's the idea. Let's find out if this can happen. And then we were able to contact these people that said, yeah, that's actually a really good idea. And if it's done correctly.
Historically, since this plan and prior to it, particularly since, there are cities that are eliminating. Milwaukee, for example, tore down part of its inner loop to heal the city with sort of its more economically disadvantaged population immediately to the north of downtown. They didn't rebuild the Embarcadero Freeway in San Francisco when it came down during an earthquake. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that what seemed crazy isn't necessarily so nuts.
I think I've told you this story before, but shortly after the Plan of Nashville was released, a group of people from Louisville contacted me and said, hey, we heard that you tore down your interstate.
<We wish. laughs>
Tell us, we want to know how to do it, because they're going through like a huge expansion now, and they kind of want to do the same thing as instead of doing that, just to tear it down.
Well, because their interstate is all along their riverfront, too. Right. Yeah.
We talked about earlier, the river really was the primary focus, I think, of one of the most dominant themes from people wanting to see a river, and here we
all
have
over the city. Yeah.
This, I think, if you were to say what is an image that you most associate with the Plan of Nashville, I would probably pick this picture, which is this watercolor that was done Ken Henley, who worked with Earl Swinson.
Yeah.
And I remember having meetings with him where we kind of said, okay, here's the base image, the photograph of what it looks like now, and you know, we want you to kind of create the vision for what this could look like. And I just think that this, to me, is really a
beautiful... Well, and there's four different versions. There's cosmetic changes where you basically sort of tweak landscaping and lighting and things like that and do a little bit of infill development. And then you go along with more links, and then you basically take the interstate on the East Bank and turn it into a boulevard. That's the final of the four.
Right. So this is used as a way to illustrate a nice riverfront, but also the idea of weaning ourselves from the interstate system. And, you know, just as a kind of a funny first note, I think the cosmetic changes, I know in this past year they've gone in and done a lot of tree plantings in the roundabout.
Right.
The,
well, and now that we've got a master plan for the riverfront, some of these things that were vaguely envisioned here now have more a specific plan attached to them.
Right.
It also shows, I think, and really was a wake-up call to a lot of people about the development potential existing on the East Bank, where we're now seeing acres of surface parking for Titans football games. It would be possible to do structured parking and do some major development and really absorb some of the expansion of population that's happening in Metro Nashville and Middle Tennessee in general, and put it right across the river from downtown. Yeah.
And the neighborhood that's shown here is a very, I would say, modest scale, probably six stories, ten at the max.
And then it's not high rise.
But it creates a really dense, great neighborhood feel. Lots of parks, and you can see at the end of the streets, that dead end at the river, there's always some type of roundabout or punctuation point where you can access a greenway. And there's a marina on the river, which I think these ideas, I think, most translated into the riverfront development plan that came about after the plan of Nashville, where we talked about this idea of layering things, where you don't just look at the river as one layer, you look at it as connections across the river. You look at it from the green standpoint of parks and greenways. You look at neighborhoods, and then you look at these points of interest. And then once you put all of those together in a layer, that's when you create a functional, successful riverfront.
So we've got the ultimate large drawing here that does exactly that.
Mm-hmm. One of the ideas I really, I think, sort of took on and really liked a lot, kind of made it a personal project for myself, was the idea of this capital axes and looking at our state capitol building and trying to really make Nashville what it, you know, visually feel like the capital of the state of Tennessee. And I think especially in a couple of different directions off of the state capitol, we've kind of ignored it. This photograph here particularly.
From the west,
which is kind of a parking lot, and the view is blocked, but you see this historical view, which was really amazing.
Well, historically, there were strong sight lines to every north, south, east, and west, particularly the east from the river, because that was originally the primary facade. I mean, when Strickland designed it, because at that point people were arriving in Nashville by boat, so the eastern facade was the facade in the main entrance. But we've cluttered all that up since then. I mean, with the Bicentennial Mall is the occasion of the preservation of the sight line to the north, but we still need to do some major work with the east and west axes. Here's the east one now, and it just kind of is right. Not.
And now it's blocked by a couple buildings, but the idea is that over time, if these buildings are ever
detonated,
but like particularly this one. I think now the justice or the new courthouse building. So I mean, but it does have some type of visual marker on it. So in the least, it would terminate that view, and then you could kind of go over to the river. Do you remember driving in on the pikes and us jumping out and taking photographs?
Yes, and we feared that we were all going to be killed because we were in the middle of essentially major arterial snapping.
Now, explain this, because I think it's interesting for people to understand, but what was the idea behind this?
Well, one of the things that, and Rick Bernhardt, who essentially wrote a section, I mean a box or a sidebar in the plan to do this, and now as head of the planning department is trying to institute some of this, the idea is that the pikes, which are the major arterials into town, historically were much more significant in transportation terms than they have become since the advent of the interstate. They were also more significant culturally because it was the place where people did most of their retail shopping, et cetera, et cetera. And they have since become these kind of like decrepit avenues into town full of competing signage, overzoned for retail development, which is why it's so sparse and so dense, so lack of density in terms of its development. And so we used Gallatin Road as an example of how one could heal the pikes by a diversity of uses along the pike itself, mid-rise residential, more sidewalks, walkability, a rational system of signalization so you don't. So, again, you have this predictability, potentially a dedicated bus lane so that you can have bus rapid transit, and just make them look a little bit better. I mean, if you got rid of all the utility wires, because we're looking at actual photographs as opposed to what it could look like. You did some minimal landscaping, got rid of the utility wires, and got control of your signage. You could have an atmosphere that people would want to stroll along and actually shop along as opposed to flee from.
And since what we talked about earlier, since these pikes are all zippers between neighborhoods, they become an asset not just for one neighborhood, but for neighborhoods on each side. So,
because you've got transportation capacity there that's not currently.
And the only way that we're going to have, I think, a successful transportation system is to really put density along these pikes.
So exactly. So that you create consumers for transportation, for public transportation. Yeah. And then we're just looking at, we addressed the issue of affordable housing. Steve Neighbors, a neighbor of mine who's had long background in this, both in public and private sector, who now actually works for the state of Tennessee doing affordable housing development. He talked about the challenges and perspectives to basically make sure that when we're redeveloping our historic neighborhoods, we do not neglect the idea of affordability, that we keep economic diversity, which is really important for the long-range health of these neighborhoods.
And then as we finish up here, these are just some of the different versions of the drawings that actually were what we called the Plan of Nashville, which is the area that we were looking at, and you can see the different iterations over a few periods of time. I remember sitting and rendering these for several hours with
more
some interns.
More than several, yeah. I bet.
I think just reaching the end here, and where we're kind of moving into some of the projects that have happened over the past 5 years. The first thing we see here is an editorial in the Tennessean that came out right after the plan was released, which I think is a really nice editorial, very positive.
Well, and I think it's interesting in that they talk about how much money the plan would cost to implement, but what we said very carefully in the conclusion was that the point is not to use public funds to implement this whole thing, to just come up with a checklist and a cost estimate and just go do it. The idea is to guide, if you're to guide public and private investment in the future, that if you're looking at, say, redevelopment in a particular area, say the East Bank, say the Phillips Meadow Yard goes away at a certain point, well, we've got some ideas about what should happen over there, so we're not just starting from scratch. And there are ideas that citizens basically have already sort of thought about and came to some conclusions about.
Based on the 10 principles, I think we could look at a few different projects. I mean, the riverfront, I think, is probably the best example, concrete example of what has happened since the Plan of Nashville and what will be happening in the next year beginning. But based on the ideas from people of reinvesting and returning to our riverfront, I think we were able to start working with the Parks Department and the Army Corps of Engineers to try to establish a riverfront master plan. And so that process began after the Plan of Nashville and went through for a public process of people's input on what they wanted to see happen. And here we have some drawings just kind of showing the phase one, which was recently announced. I believe we'll start construction sometime in 2010.
I think that's right, yes. The mayor has committed funding for phase one.
I think the public art component is also really important, because this was integrated into the Plan of Nashville's meetings as well, where the Arts Commission came to us and said, you're undergoing these meetings for the Plan of Nashville. Can we kind of have a series of special meetings just devoted to public art? And so if you look in the book, there's this whole section on public art with a sidebar by Jack Mackey, who is a public artist from Seattle. And that was really inspiring for us, because we were able to start to see what other cities have done with their public art program. And here is kind of some sketches of the next public art piece, which will be in the public square. And it's these really kind of fun, iconic looking figures that I think you can turn and pivot.
Right. Okay, so how are we going to summarize?
We've got... Well, the latest...
What we're talking about now is things that have happened after the Plan of Nashville, and we've talked about the Riverfront Master Plan, the public art plan for the city that evolved through the Plan of Nashville
process. Streetscaping is probably, that was obviously talked about. Dedrick Street is a good example Church Street, I think, is probably our first example of a streetscape that's just really creating a nice place to be in downtown.
Which goes back to the principle of essentially
reestablishing your streets
the streets. And they're outdoor rooms for the population.
And Dedrick Street has even gone beyond that because it's integrated environmental sustainability.
Yes.
It's considered the first green street in the state. And so I think if you look at Church Street, those types of things weren't really the issue when Church Street was done. So we've kind of added a whole nother level of thought to that. Here we have a timeline again. This is a timeline of Nashville's kind of green ribbon process, which I think is the latest big thing the city has undertaken. And really does, I think, if you read the report, it encompasses a lot of ideas from the Plan of Nashville and goes beyond really strengthening that idea of Nashville becoming a city that is a green city and pays attention to these issues, which we have talked about before. This wasn't sort of the big catchphrase that it is now back when we were doing the Plan of Nashville, but it still is all about sustainability, because if you look at these principles, that kind of embodies the idea of a sustainable city.
Exactly.
I want to thank Christine Kraling for joining me today for this podcast from the Nashville Downtown Public Library. I'd also like to thank Liz Coleman with the library for letting us come and do this today. Thank you very much, and we really appreciate you tuning in. Thank you.